It all began in a tent. In Hebrews 11, verse 8, it says, "By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise, for he was looking forward to the city with foundations whose architect and builder is God." Can you imagine being Abraham and Sarah, leaving a wonderfully civilized, well-built home and city to say, you know what, we're going to go off and live out in the wilderness? You think they met with any objections from family and friends? A little counsel, a little wise word saying, you don't want to do this. You don't want to go. Do you think Sarah's family objected to her going off? Did the Lord ever call you to get up and to go do something that just seemed a bit outrageous to family or friends? To go to a far country that was not your home? How do you answer? What do you say? Samuel Johnson once wrote that nothing will ever be accomplished if every objection must be overcome. It's very true. Abraham moves. Eventually he gets to the promised land. He settles there. And we're told in Genesis chapter 15 that the Lord met him there. Genesis 15:1, "After this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid," God had said to him here. "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your very great reward." What was God promising there? What was his reward to be? God promised to bless this man with he himself. God himself was going to be his blessing, like a covering over him. A cover of blessing. And was this just for him? We're just reading a historical event here. This was a one-off, a one-time thing promised just to Abraham. It's just not that way. In the New Testament, in Galatians 3, I love this passage, famous passage. Galatians chapter 3, verse 26, it says, "You are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For all of you who were baptized into Christ have clothed yourselves with Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. If you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise." The promise. Who else does that promise live for today but for those of us, the sons and daughters of God who are alive on this planet right now, right here, standing up to do the will of God? The promise is for you. The promise covers you and your home, your family. We see these promises of God working all throughout history, following the children of God, the children of Abraham, and now today the spiritual children of Abraham. Eventually, those children ended up down in Egypt, and they, after serving under a very good Pharaoh, fell into the hands of one who was not so good, who placed them in slavery. But then the Lord springs them from their captivity, and after powerful and miraculous events, they are led to Mount Sinai. And here we find them again in a similar situation in Exodus 19, if you'd like to see it with me. Exodus 19, verse 1, it says, "The third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on the very day they came to the desert of Sinai. After they set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai. And Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain." So again, they're back in tents as Abraham, their forefather, had been. back in the tents. You know, you think about that life and the camp life there at Mount Sinai. They're lined up in tents, and you remember they had orders too. They weren't just kind of scattered about wherever they wanted to be. They were lined up according to tribe. Those tribes divided into neat rows and sections, and then those tribes by families. So, you know, it was very well laid out, this camp. They had running water, an abundant source of fresh running water. They had food. They had the presence of God right there on that mountainside in very dramatic fashion. Communications with him. Why did they ever leave? Why would you ever leave that spot? Here you are, you're safe from the rest of the world. You've got God right there. Why ever go? Why did they go? Well, it was the Lord himself, wasn't it, who pushed them to go on. There was more water out there to be had. The food seemed to follow them wherever they went. And the presence of God went before them. He wanted them to move on, and he promised to move with them, to stay beside them wherever it was that he was going to lead. They had lives to get on to. They had a promised land to get to, farms to be planted, towns and cities to be built, children to be born, weddings to celebrate, and the cause of God to spread to the entire world. There were things to do, things to get on with. God needed them to move to the next level. Easy? Not so much easy. The Navy Seabees back in World War II had a slogan. I don't know if they still do today. Maybe they do. God bless them. These Seabees who built airstrips in the middle of jungles, who built basically cities on a beach, had a slogan, and it said, "The difficult we do immediately. The impossible takes a little longer." Good slogan for us as children of God. Now, sometimes the children of Israel got in a little out of hand. They'd get into some trouble. Sometimes after the thrill of their deliverance had worn off and the routine of daily living set in, the routine of the weekly worship service got a little bit tiresome to them, they would get involved in the behavior and the religion of their neighbors, because that religion seemed to be very exciting after what they'd been doing week in and week out, month in and month out. Very exciting and new. All the senses were firing at those religious services of their neighbors. Wild music, dramatic scenes, excitement all around. But when they let themselves get away from the Lord's simple faith and from a dependence on an innocent lamb for the foundation of their religious practice, what happened to this cover of blessing that sheltered the people? What happened to it? It lifted. It always lifted. Trouble would come. Difficulties would set in. But when the people repented and when they returned to the Lord, what happened then? Well, as the Lord himself says in Isaiah 1, verse 16, "Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they are red as crimson, they shall be like wool." The Lord would forgive, and he would restore. The blessings would return. The promises were always there. The people would get back up, they'd be built back up, and then they would go on to what was next, to what God had called and set them to do. There was a woman, I hope I haven't told you this story, I don't think I have, but I've known it for so long, I think that maybe I did, a woman named Clara Null. She described what she described as probably the worst days, one of the worst days of her life. Her washing machine had broken, the telephone wouldn't stop ringing. She had a headache to just beat the band. The mail carrier came and brought the mail, and in it was a bill, big bill, that she had no money to pay. She said that really she was almost at the breaking point. She had a one-year-old child. Maybe that was part of it. But she took this little boy, one-year-old child, she sets him up in his high chair, and she puts on the little plastic tray, you know, locked that in. She pulled up a chair right beside him, and she just laid her head on his tray and just started crying, just crying. And she says, without a sound, without a word, all of a sudden her little boy just took the pacifier out of his mouth and he stuck it in hers. Lord knows what we need, isn't that right? The Lord knows exactly what we need and when we need it. And He's promised to mind us. These promises, right here from Abraham, right to us, He's promised to mind us, to be with us. I am your shield and your very great reward. He continued, of course, to lead Israel. Eventually, they come right up to the Jordan River. Now it's time to cross. They have Joshua leading. It's time to go. The king of Moab, though, has been nervous about them, a little scared of them. They're still in his territory, and they're massive. They just displace every nation that they come up against. And so the king of Moab sends for a man named Balaam. He sends to Mesopotamia for Balaam. Balaam is a prophet, a fellow who gets real results when he, you know, sets about doing whatever it is that he was supposed to do. So he sends for Balaam to come and to curse these Israelites for him so that he with his army might be able to go out and whip them, scare them off, run them off. The first children's story I ever told, 30 years ago now, back in the old San Marcos church, was about Balaam and his donkey. Great story. Love that story. But a little bit farther down, once Balaam finally makes it there to Moab, look with me in Numbers chapter 24. He tries to curse them, and it doesn't work out. He offers a blessing. The king gets upset and says, listen, let's try this a different way. We'll go to a different place. And so they go up there on Pisgah's lofty heights, up there by Mount Nebo. This is, I don't know if you're familiar with the way that the Jordan River runs there just before it gets to the Dead Sea. Just before it enters the Dead Sea, on one side of the river, you've got Jericho in this big, wide valley, very fertile valley. On this side of the river, though, opposite of Jericho, was Peor, Beth Peor. The Israelites are camped now in this valley on this side of the river, spread out, lovely and tents. And so the king takes Balaam up to a high mountain up there where it is that Moses dies when he sees, but he peers down and he can see all the tents of Israel, and they're lined up in those perfect segments and squares and lines and rows. Just beautiful from a distance. It says here in Numbers 24, look at verse 2. Yeah, Numbers 24, 2. When Balaam looked out and saw Israel encamped tribe by tribe, the Spirit of God came upon him and he uttered his oracle. The oracle of Balaam, son of Beor, the oracle of one whose eyes see clearly, the oracle of one who hears the words of God, who sees a vision from the Almighty, who falls prostrate and whose eyes are open. How beautiful are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel. I take great comfort from the fact that the Lord called His people out and He set them in tents while they were on their way. How beautiful are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel. Like valleys they spread out, like gardens beside a river, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars beside the waters. Water will flow from their buckets. Their seed will have abundant water. Their king will be greater than Agag. Their kingdom will be exalted. God brought them out of Egypt. They have the strength of a wild ox. They devour hostile nations. They break their bones in pieces. With their arrows they pierce them. Like a lion they crouch and lie down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse them? May those who bless you be blessed. May those who curse you be cursed. This is the exact same words that God had spoken to Abraham earlier. May God bless those who... May God bless you. And those who bless you be blessed, and may those who curse you be cursed. It's an encouragement and a caution for us to this day, since these promises to Israel come down to spiritual Israel, that we ought to be liberal with our blessings to each other, and be very careful who we curse. Yeah? Balak, the king of Moab, he heard these blessings again and he was very upset. It's not what I brought you here for. It's not what I'm paying you here for. And Balaam says, oh wait, there's more. Verse 17. He says, I see him. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will rise out of Israel. This, of course, is that great passage that the wise men used when they showed up in Jerusalem saying, hey, we've seen the star, the one who's to be born, the King of the Jews. And they went down to Bethlehem and they found him, because the newborn king, in fact, had come. And under the grace of his father's care, he grew, ending up doing all that was necessary to secure our salvation. He himself becoming the first fruits of God's promise to Abraham. It's funny how that promise involved the very smallest tent in Christendom. You know, I have on my computer screensaver, one at home and the one that I use, the laptop that we use here at church. It's a picture of the garden tomb, and in front of it is the agapantha plant, but it has a different name, a more common. What is that name, Mike, about the Lily of the Nile? That's what it is. Beautiful plant. I have them planted right outside my study at home. But there's this Lily of the Nile, and it's growing up there before the garden tomb. In this picture, you see it, you see the tomb, and you can see the, it's right down to the bedrock there, the little cuts that have been made in that bedrock, in that tomb, and it's, you just can't think about the wonderful things that happened there. It begins with sadness, but there's nothing but wonder after it. Anyways, this smallest tent in Christendom, it belonged to Jesus. It was his. Look at the Gospel of John, chapter 19. John 19, verse 38. It says, later, Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now, Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly because he feared the Jews. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away. He was accompanied by Nicodemus, the man who earlier had visited Jesus at night. Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds. Taking Jesus' body, the two of them wrapped it with the spices in strips of linen. This was in accordance with Jewish burial customs. At the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid. Because it was the Jewish day of preparation, and since the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. And then the last thing they did, after they'd wrapped Jesus' body, they took a linen cloth, just a square cloth like this, a handkerchief-sized cloth, and they laid it over his face, like a tent, just draping over his face. They'd put his arms, cross the arms, as their custom was, over the chest, and then they placed that cloth right there over his face. Chapter 20, verse 1. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, who is John, the one Jesus loved, and said, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they have put him. So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and he looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter, who was behind him, arrived and went into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. The Adventist commentary on this little episode, it says the fact that the cloth was folded and set there neatly beside it, they say that makes a case that there was no grave robbers involved in this situation, because what grave robbers would take the time to unwrap a body and to fold up the linens neatly and place them there inside the tomb? I think that's a good point. I like the points from the book Desire of Ages a little bit better, though, who say that he who created this universe, who created the atom, who created everything that we are, who set everything in order, was in no hurry, that there was no panic. And he took his time and he completed his work. He folded up the things neatly because that's just the way he is. And then he set about going to the next thing. You know, I wouldn't have blamed Jesus for just throwing those things off and bursting out of the tomb, but that's just not the way he is. It was important to him to fold up those linens. He completes every work that he begins. Isn't that right? Does he leave anything undone? He completes every work that he begins. When one thing is done, he folds it up and then he moves to the next. He had a work to do, as he had promised Abraham, and it was up to him to fulfill it. This was the first promise here. It's Genesis chapter 12, the first one to Abraham. Genesis 12, verse 1. In my Bible, it says here, the call of Abram. Genesis 12, 1. The Lord said to Abram, "Leave your country and your people and your father's household and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." The God who made the promise is the God who fulfilled that promise. And that becomes now our calling and our promise. In the same way, God called you, made a promise to you. He has a work to do in you, and he has a work to do through you. If that work was complete, none of you would be here this morning. But the calling's here, the promise is here, the work is here, and so we all look for what's next. We open ourselves up to him and say, "Lord, send me. What's next?" If indeed this is the last worship we are to ever to conduct in this tabernacle, then let these be the last official words proclaimed under this covering. We were here. We were here out of love and devotion for Jesus Christ.